Fanning. Weekends on 2FM.
In the last week, the death was announced of Michael Lang. He's the co-creator and promoter of the 1969 Woodstock Music Festival. Against the backdrop of the Vietnam War, the legendary festival was billed as 3 days of peace and music. A deluge of disillusioned young Americans, nearly 500,000, descended on land owned by farmer Max Yasgur in Bethel, which is about 50 miles northwest of New York City. Performers ranged from Jimi Hendrix to The Who to Jefferson Airplane to the brilliant Incredible String Band, by the way, who weren't in the movie, so a lot of people didn't know they were even there. Anyway, it was all very chaotic, but it's gone down as a defining moment in history. Well, back about 10 years ago, Michael Lang visited the Electric Picnic here in Ireland, and we managed to get him into the 2FM Roadcaster to have a chat with me. And I'm going to just give you a little bit of that chat now. We'll jump in here. Tell me about Woodstock and tell me how it all happened or didn't happen. First of all, like, the gig happened actually 67 miles from Woodstock. It was 3 days of peace and love. It supposedly reflected the ideals and convictions of a generation of kindred spirits, if you like. Did it?
I think it did very well. I think we sort of managed to prove to ourselves, at least to ourselves, that when we got together, we could live the life we had been, you know, looking to sort of convert the world into.
And what is that life?
It's a life where people get along with respect for each other, where you know, your first instinct is to help rather than to hurt. Where you have respect for each other, for the planet, for you know, life itself, in a way that I think builds a family rather than separates people.
Okay, well then tell me, just like, okay, it's 3 days in August 1969, you put on the Woodstock Festival. Go back a month to the middle of July. Was everything in order?
Nothing was over. In the middle of July, we had lost a site we'd been working on for 3.5 months and looked like we were doomed. And we put out the word, the day that we lost the site, we put out the word, you know, on radio and to every contact we had, real estate people all over the state of New York, hoping for something to come up. And by a miracle, something did the next day.
Okay, the something that did was a farmer called Max Yasgur who said, hey, you can use my place. Now, he knew that you were in a sticky situation, and he was a pretty damn good businessman. And he made more money out of those 3 days from you than if he had sold the damn farm to you.
That's true. But to be fair, I mean, you know, when we worked out the deal, which was the moment we saw the field, frankly, he and I walked out and made the deal. The price was really reasonable for us. I mean, it was a lot of money for him, and it sort of saved his farm, I think, that summer. But for what we had in mind, I thought the price was fair.
Okay, let's just take a look at what Woodstock was in terms of just the numbers. How many were in there? How many were out there?
There was, I mean, the cops put it at 600,000, actually, on the site, 2 million on the road. That's pretty close to probably what it was.
And when you found out there was 100-mile tailbacks, that, like, we're talking New York here, but they closed the Canadian border.
That's right.
How scared were you? You must have at some stage said, right, I'm out of here.
No, I never thought I'd leave, actually. I never thought I'd leave. By the end of that weekend, we thought that was our lives. You know, we were going to just stay there forever. Some people actually did stay. But no, I think we knew we were in the middle of something unique. It's a lucky thing, frankly, that all of the 2 million didn't get there, because then we would have had real big problems, and I don't think we could have handled them. But I think with what we had on site and the fact that we were prepared for 200,000 and that we overbuilt everything and that we had incredibly smart people working for us, we were able to stretch everything and make it work through the weekend.
Okay, the fact that you had so many people, one of the things was that if people know the albums of Woodstock or have ever seen the movie, and of course one of the reasons why people know so much about just what happened at Woodstock is because of that movie, like all around the world, people who weren't there, or people even who were there and had a look at it again, and the movie was great. Yeah. One of the reasons is, like, you know, so many people came and got in free, and you said it was a free concert, but it was only because of the fact that you didn't have boots up to sell damn tickets.
Yeah, that's right. We that was sort of a big flaw in our planning, was not to have places to sell tickets. Most people were coming and looking for a place to buy tickets. I'm sure there were some people who thought they wanted to get in for free. And frankly, we prepared for that. We had free campgrounds. We had free stages. We wanted everybody who wanted to be a part of it to be able to be there. And we wanted to take care of them through the weekend. We had sold about 185,000 tickets in advance, so we knew this was going to be huge. I mean, generally, if that's your advance sale, your walk-up's going to be that or more. How much more, we had no idea, frankly. But by the Monday, we had probably 50,000 kids in the field, and it was building through the week. And so we knew what we were in for. And we just prepared as best we could.
Okay, and it was a career-defining moment for so many people. I mean, it was the first time people had really seen, and you're very proud of the fact, Santana, say, would be a good example. And you've said before, the one that really did it for you was Sly and the Family Stone. Yeah. Why?
Because Sly created this energy with the crowd that I've never seen replicated by anyone, and I mean the Beatles or the Stones or anybody. He had this rapport with the audience and got everybody into this energy exchange between the stage and the audience. We thought it was going to levitate. It was phenomenal, and it really reached everybody. If you look at the film, you can see people sort of at the top of that bowl, just completely engrossed.
This weekend, Burning Man is on. Is that the ultimate in terms of, that's the one that has a somewhat Woodstock spirit, mainly to do with the environment?
It does indeed. And, you know, their tenet is what you bring in, you take out. And that goes for, you know, ashes from your cigarettes or a napkin or a tissue. Whatever you bring to that site, you take away with you. You leave nothing behind.
Yeah.
Because of their respect for the environment. And it's, you know, it's interesting. It's not really a music festival. It's an arts festival.
No,
it's kind of an anarchist arts festival. And a lot of that is you know, a lot of what Woodstock was about, too.
Well, then what about the music? Burning Man isn't music. This one is. Woodstock was as well. What about the power of music to influence constructively a society? People did really believe that. And, like, people can look back and say that music was just in the background of, say, ending the Vietnam War. But others would say it's right up there in the forefront, and it was the cement that put a whole generation together.
Oh,
anything that Crosby, Stills, Nash, or any of those bands sang about all the time. So do you still see that that's capable or that's a possibility?
It was very much in the forefront. But, you know, it was interesting. And that was a period of time, late 60s, when just about every one of the major bands was writing about the war and the way we should try and live together and the ecology. And they were really reflecting everything that was going on in the subculture in a very real way. It was very little boy meets girl, you know that kind of lyric in those days. It was very much involved in what we were involved in. And I think that's unique kind of in history. And it always has the power to do that. There's always going to be that song that will inspire. I just don't think the concentration of it will ever sort of be the same. I think music business has gone, you know, in too many different directions.
Well, directly after, and not too far after, Woodstock came the Ultimate Festival, Rolling Stones, a guy gets killed in front of the stage, all these kind of things. And people said, you know, the dream, no question about it, was Woodstock. The nightmare, no question about it, was Ultimate. But I think you'd probably see something that happened later when American soldiers killed, shot dead, four American students on in Kent State University.
Yeah.
Was that the end of it all?
I think it was the end of it all, and really the wake-up call for everyone. I think, it was...
The wake-up call of what, this dream couldn't last forever?
Well, not just that the dream couldn't last forever, but for both sides. I think it was, you know, hold on, this is really gotten out of hand. I mean, this polarity, you know, in the country has really gotten too far, and we really need to sort of step back. Both sides need to sort of step back and see how to get back, you know, to a sane environment. It just gotten so bizarre that we were shooting our own kids. I mean,
What about the logistics of the whole idea of the festival itself? I mean, the fact that it got so big, there was no social networking, no mobiles. I have no idea if there was faxes. Were there faxes?
There were faxes.
Were there faxes?
Just the beginning of faxes. Yeah.
Really, was it?
Yeah,
okay. And like, you know, like trying to even just coordinate and get in touch with, and like,
well, you know, a lot of it was word of mouth. I mean, what was interesting about Woodstock, I remember being at Steve Paul's Scene, which is a club in New York City. And I went there to book a band, and Jimi Hendrix was playing that night, and I'd already been talking to Jimmy's management, but there was a band called Sean and I was playing.
Yeah.
And I went backstage and booked them.
Retro 50s.
Yeah, exactly. You know, just sort of tip of the hat to the rock and roll. And we talked in the club about what Woodstock was going to be, and 3 days later I was getting calls from California. So word of mouth was very powerful, and we also used the underground newspaper, the underground press, you know, very heavily. This became, because it was really something we wanted the subculture to feel they owned. And the power of that kind of word of mouth is very strong, and it works as fast as any, you know, social media we have today.
You had to dig wells, lay down pipes, you had to build stages, an awful lot against planning laws, trying to dodge the guys who were saying you can't build this, can't build that. You realised you had to do that. When, like, famously in the album and in the movie, Richie Havens is the first man on stage and sings Freedom, and it was the most famous moment, we all have seen that kind of thing. Do you breathe a sigh of relief when he was on stage? Okay, it started, at least the concentration is now on the music.
Totally, because, you know, in an event like that, and especially in those days when, you know, without cell phones and without other means of communication, the stage is really how you communicate with the audience, you know, and that's really where everybody focuses, and that's what's going to keep everybody feeling secure. And the fact that Richie went on and when we flipped the switch up, the sound worked was, you know, the magic moment for me. I knew that the rest was going to be okay.
And how many people there could really hear what was going on stage with what I would call, compared to today, primitive equipment? I mean, you're talking 600,000 or 700,000 people there, another 1.5 million outside, etc. Could everybody hear? I know it's a natural bowl, the Yasgur's Farm.
Not everybody, but people in the bowl could hear, and everybody else could sort of catch the vibe.
Simple as that.
Yeah.
Okay, there was one band on stage there, was one of the biggest bands around the time, which was The Who.
Yeah.
And they weren't anything, whatever way you define the counterculture and the bands that associated with it and the bands that could relate to it, The Who weren't that kind of band at all.
No, they weren't, but they were very much loved, and they were very important in the music scene. And they were at the end of a tour. They didn't want to be there. They wanted to go home. Pete was like miserable for the moment.
Pete Townsend was a pain in the arse. Yeah. Let's be honest.
He was just, you know.
Since then, of course, he's praised it because it's...
Well, it turned out to be the most important gig of their career.
Oh, yeah.
But at the time, he just didn't want any part of it. And there's a famous, you know, story that I love to tell about Abbie Hoffman grabbing the microphone in the middle of their
Abbie
set.
Hoffman, yeah.
Yeah. Talking about John Sinclair, who was kind of an activist and had been busted for two joints and sent to jail for 15 years. And
which John Lennon sang about on his New York City album.
That's right. Yeah. And Abbie just, you know, couldn't restrain himself from jumping up at the mic when he saw it was open. It happened that Pete had turned to adjust his amp, and when he turned back, there was Abbie.
Yeah. And Pete had a weapon in his hand, a guitar.
He did. And he used it well.
he did use it well, yeah, exactly, yeah. And the Grateful Dead didn't like the gig they played, but actually looking back, it was fine.
Yeah, it was fine. I mean, the problem with the Dead was their sound man, Owsley Stanley, who was famous for two things in America. He was famous as the Grateful Dead sound man, and he was also famous as the largest producer of LSD in the world. And when you mix those two things, interesting things can happen. And right before that set, he rewired the stage. And so they were getting shocks, and all kinds of things were happening when they were playing.
Why did Woodstock not become a catastrophe?
I think because everybody wanted it to work. Everybody was there really trying to make this something very much a special spiritual moment for themselves and for everyone else. And we became this big family very early on. And I think that's why it worked. When adversity, you know, opened its maw, people just came together to deal with it and share the experience.
Well, then what about the time itself? I mean, 3 months later, the 60s was over. And we had, like, you know, the Woodstock generation was the Kennedy generation. You've said that before.
Yes.
It's very important on that level. Now, the two Kennedys have been assassinated. Martin Luther King had been assassinated the year before. And also, you know, Neil Armstrong, he had walked on the moon a few weeks before.
Yes.
It was a very special time. But the big unifying thing was, what in the name of God are we doing in Vietnam?
That was definitely the core, you know, unifying element, of at least of those years. But I think it went beyond that. I think it went to... how do we live together on the planet, you know, and survive in a way that furthers humanity rather than, you know, deals with conflict in a way that's expected. In other words, this is how the world's going to be, and this is just how our lives are going to be. I think we were looking for, you know, to bring people to a higher plane, to evolve beyond those kinds of ways of dealing with things. And I think for those 3 days, we did.
Okay, when you saw what Woodstock became in the decades afterwards, and you can't obviously go anywhere any day of the week in the last 40 years without somebody mentioning the name Woodstock to you, obviously, because you're the man who put the gig on. When you saw just how important it was, and people are called literally the Woodstock generation, and just how important that was in the West, and how important it will be forever in the history books. And then in 2008, Obama gets elected, and people said that Washington, this was Washington's Woodstock. Did you get it?
I got it, totally. Because, you know, what Woodstock was a moment of hope, you know, in the midst of a very dark time. There was this hope that people could actually get along. And it extended to the cops, it extended to the people in the town, it extended to all the kids on the ground. And I think it translated that idea into the world, you know, and mostly through the film, frankly, outside of America, where there is hope for us. And I think what they were talking about at that inauguration was that there is hope for us again, that hope survives.
Okay, well, in terms of a generation, does it have to be a festival? Does it have to be a big concert for 3 days? I mean, the spirit, the zeitgeist that you capture, the time, etc. I mean, the now of that time, can it be done?
Yeah, but I don't think it has to be a festival. I think it could be anything.
All right, listen, Michael Lang, the man who got Woodstock together. Thank you very much indeed for talking to us, Michael. It's been
my
a real pleasure.
Pleasure.
And that is Michael Lang indeed from about 10 years ago when we were talking at the Electric Picnic. Michael Lang, who died earlier this week.
Dave Fanning, weekends on 2FM.